think when you have a sense of originality and don't follow trend, there's a timelessness to the work that resonates with people.
This is The Safari. The Safari is a tour around the consumer, brand, and retailing industry. And we have the great privilege here at my company, Traub, to really be exposed to many of the great minds of the industry who are forming and shaping the future of many different parts of the consumer, brand, and retail world. And I felt it was quite interesting for us to be able to not only learn from all of those people as we do every day, but memorialize it into a podcast, which could then be shared with many of our friends and clients and you, obviously, the listener.
Hi, this is Kate Durge. Welcome to The Safari. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Michael Aram, owner and founder of the global luxury decor and tableware brand, Michael Aram, known for its lively pieces full of character and craftsmanship. Michael and I talk about how a trip to India 35 years ago sparked his creative inspiration and led to a growing of a business centered around handmade art and design for all generations. It's a wonderful conversation, and I hope you enjoy. So welcome. I'm thrilled to be here today with Michael Aram, and what a treat. Michael, I have been such a fan of yours, your homeware, your decorative items for such a long time, and I'm thrilled to bring you to our listeners today. So welcome, Michael Aram.
Thank you, Kate. It's my pleasure being here. It's such a delight.
Oh, well, it's a delight to have you. And where do we find you today?
So I'm in my office in sunny West Palm Beach, Florida, where we've been for the last 3 years now, having left New York.
And was that a COVID? That was a COVID escape?
Yes, we came down just at the beginning of COVID. You know, we're lucky enough to move our whole sales, marketing, creative, all of the sort of US side of the business here with us. It was such a crazy time in New York at that point. And, we were all looking for options on how to live and how to get through it. And, we were able to move 7 families down with us from New York, who were all at a really wonderful time in their lives where they could just pick up and try something different. So we have an amazing team now down here, and I will say it really is like living in paradise, and coming to work is a joy. I still spend a fair amount of my time, of course, in New Delhi, where we have our workshop, and I have a parallel design studio, and of course, travel around the world as well and all over the country for events.
Amazing. Well, I'm very envious because here we are in February in New York City, which is not as sunny and bright as where you are today. So send us some sunshine.
Absolutely.
But in the meantime, I'm excited to get into things here because, I think you're such a well-known brand, and I'd love to hear a little bit about where you started and how you began. And you talked about India just now, but I'd love to start at the beginning because I've read so much about your start in the art world and how you really actually started in a museum in your career.
Yeah. Well, when I was a kid, I'll start way back. Sorry, Kate. But when I was a kid, I just loved to make things and, was always taking things apart and putting them back together, much to my mother's chagrin. Mm. She'd come home and discover the washing machine was in pieces, but I would get it back together. For me, making things was always about trying to understand the world around me. I really used to just wonder, what are we doing here? Why are we here? What is life? What is death? What is regeneration? What does it mean to be alive and, to be part of this world? So I had a very early fascination with, how things worked, but also nature. And my parents were very avid gardeners. We were always sent to the yard with a shopping bag to go and weed the rose garden or whatever. But I love nature, and I love nature also as a way to understand, the world around me. And One of the things I would always do, I'd always be made fun of in my family because I would always sort of arrive home and go right to the basement where I had a little workshop where I would, you know, make dollhouse furniture for my sister's dollhouse or, you know, refinish furniture or just make things and, you know, take radios apart and put them back together, whatever it was, just as a way to understand things. And that process sort of led me to, you know, making art and loving art. And, you know, that was the one subject I think I really, really connected with at school the most. And so, you know, when I went to college, it was sort of a natural for me, you know, to understand and to study art. So I went and, you know, got my degree in art history, but always with a very strong background in studio art and fine art as well. I studied in Bates College in Lewiston, Maine, and then went on to the University of Florence in Italy and took a lot of studio art courses, you know, in Europe as well as back in New York, and was just about to start, you know, my career as a fine artist in New York. Started to exhibit a little bit in the East Village back in those days in the mid-80s. I had a really great job at the Metropolitan Museum of Art designing books and posters. Mm-hmm. Which was fantastic for me because I was surrounded by fine art all day long and also, you know, making an applied art, you know, books, posters. It was my first real foray into product design, which was really important for me as well.
Fantastic. So how did that background lead you as you progressed? You know, how did you get out of the museum and into fine arts and the creation of what you're doing?
So I took a trip to India, you know, while I was working at the Met. I decided I would take a month-long trip and go to visit friends. And while I wasn't, my friends were living in New Delhi. Mm. And while they were at work all day, I would just get lost in the old city, in Old Delhi. And, you know, one of the things I love to do when I travel is go a little bit like off the beaten track and really get lost in cities to really understand them as a non-tourist, if you mm-hmm. will.
Yeah.
So I would go up and down all the back lanes of old Delhi. And, you know, this was 1988. It was a very different city than it is today. You know, my friends never went to the old city because you couldn't take your car into the city. It was sort of an off-limits area for, mm-hmm. for the new Delhiites, you know, heavily Muslim, heavily non-English speaking. And just very hard to really navigate. So for me, it was fascinating. And what was amazing to me, it was like entering an Aladdin's cave of craft. You know, there were things being made all around me, buckets, shovels, scissors, samovars. I mean, you know, it was just unbelievable, those kind of things that you would see. And for me, as someone who was working in books and posters at the Met, even to see like the hot metal typefaces and, you know, the hand engraving and the hand-bound books.
Yeah.
They were crazy, you know. So I would just go around and get, you know, business cards made for myself with the hot, you know, the hot metal typefaces that were incredible, these old antique typefaces that were still being used, and, you know, getting, you know, notebooks hand-bound for myself. But one of the crafts that I really was really fixated with were the metal crafts, because, you know, as an artist in New York City, I could draw and I could paint in my little West Village apartment, but there was no way I could work in metal. It always seemed like a material that was more or less off limits to me as an artist, just because of the complication of working the material. Mm-hmm. And of course, the high cost of production for sculptures and for casting. So for me, it was like, you know, really being in this unbelievable playground, if you will. It was just, I don't know, I was just so fascinated just watching and observing.
That's incredible.
The most talented and incredible craftspeople, but craftspeople who were working in the most humble way. But from my perspective, you know, these were, you know, handmade objects that just spoke to the soul of the maker, you know, and they had this "I made this" quality to them, which did not exist in 1988. If we can remember back, you know, to this whole sort of, you know, state-of-the-art Italian design industrial moment in our design world, you know, where everything looked like it popped out of a machine.
Yeah, so
and,
true.
You know, we didn't have words like organic or handmade mm-hmm. or, you know, none of that was part of the design vocabulary back in 1988. And for me, you know, it was just this amazing fusion of, you know, of an outsider with local crafts. The local craft scene in New Delhi at that point were completely underappreciated and dismissed. You know, everything that the, I mean, really, when I say the craftsmen were making were not really relevant or appreciated by the local community. Mm. In those days, the only people who were really working in India were the likes of, you know, Pier One, or this was even sort of, you know, Pottery Barn just was happening, beginning to happen. Yeah. But, you know, it was really a bad brand. This Made in India brand was not a good brand. You know, it was always considered bad quality, I'm afraid to say, but it really was. And the designs that came out of it didn't have the sensitivity to the handmade process. You know, in those days, the buyers would come in to India, you know, give the exporter a piece to copy, maybe a piece made in Italy, maybe a piece made in Germany. And the result, you know, didn't quite match, you know, the intent, you know, because, you know, I always say to my team, you know, we're not Mercedes-Benz. Let's not be Mercedes-Benz. Right. Let's do what they can't do, you know? So let's show the hand-cut edge. Let's show the hand-forged metal, you know, let's show our fingerprint in the casting because we made this piece, you know, that everything should really, you know, bear the hallmark of the maker, you know, and as simple and boring and, you know, sort of universal as that sounds now, when I started my business, that was sort of mind blowing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, I go back and I get really heavy into it where, you know, I just think that, you know, to give dignity to that process, you know, and to be proud of the fact that, you know, we're not Mercedes-Benz, you know, darn it, but look what we can do, you know, was such a powerful thing then. And I'll never forget my first New York gift show. We showed in an area called New York Now. I had a small table, which was, I mean, maybe half the size of a folding table, where I had five things that I had made. You know, I had picked up, you know, twigs on my morning walk and cut them and had them cast in brass, and had forged forks and spoons that I welded at the top of them. You know, I used to find, you know, the different crafts, and there was no trade shows. There was no phone book. There was nothing in those days, you know, in terms of infrastructure for finding, you know, finding vendors or finding craftsmen except for walking. But, you know, I'd hear the beating of the metal and I'd follow my ear. I would smell the burning of the molasses with the sand casting process and would follow my nose. You know, I would sort of, you know, gesticulate and ask or somehow find out, you know, where can I get this polished? Where can I get this welded? Right. And would just roam around. Oh my gosh, I would see things on the back of auto, you know, bicycle rickshaws and just follow the rickshaw to find out where it was going, you know, to just sort of find a little network of craftsmen. So I had this small table, you know, I had the funny steel hammered bowls with all the dents and the funny little crooked edge.
Yeah.
I had my twig cutlery, which, you know, was, you know, very, very organic. I had some, you know, tripod candlesticks. Oh, I had done these candlesticks that I had sculpted that looked like trees also. But I was just working with whatever I had at hand because, you know, I hadn't set up a workshop yet. You know, I was just working literally with my hands and making what I could make. But I'll remember, like, you know, it was so, so different, you know, at that point. And thankfully, our first collection was just really, really well received.
Well, I was going to ask about that. How did you translate all of that? Because that is so beautiful, Michael, just in terms of, you know, the respect that you had for the craftsmanship and the appreciation and, you know, taking that inspiration, but how do you translate that into this, you know, this global business and brand that you have created? Because, to maintain that craftsmanship, I think that is what you do so well and what does stand you out, but you were certainly a pioneer in that sense. So,
well, I discovered early on, that if I was going to make things that I didn't want to live in an ivory tower. I couldn't afford to live in an ivory tower, that I had to, I always say, bite the dirt and do it. So, you know, after being at the New York Gift Show and getting my first few orders, and it wasn't huge, of course, but getting my first orders, I actually emptied out my bank account in New York. I don't even want to tell you how little was in there, but maybe I will. It was $2,000.
Oh my gosh.
I stopped in Paris for one night and spent $200 of it and arrived back in India with $1,800 and started my business, you know. And, you know, I always say we're the 35-year-old overnight success. You know, it's our 35th year in business, but we just started, you know, started small and built up. I understood very early on that if I wanted to produce in India, that I would make it myself. Not only because I wanted to ensure that, you know, I was connected to the process, but that we would get our deliveries, that I could stand by our product, and that, you know, whatever we made could be made. I wouldn't promise something that I couldn't deliver, you know. And that was a challenge early on for me, because, you know, there were just so many factors in India. You know, it's still not an easy place to work, I don't think. But in those days, it really, really wasn't easy. When I tell you it was pre-fax machine, when I tell you that, you know, getting a telephone was not something that was readily, you know, possible. It was just a very, very challenging place. Now, of course, it's changed so hugely in the 35 years since I've been there. But yeah. Initially, it was not an easy place to work. And I had just decided that if I was going to commit to doing what I loved, that I would commit myself to the making process as well. So we became a manufacturing brand as well, and always had our own workshop, and even to this day have our own workshop, which is amazing.
Still to this day in India, but you have as well in New York, correct?
Well, no, New York is just, I mean, here in the States, I just am able to, you know, sales, marketing, design, but we have our own sample making workshop production facility in New Delhi, mm-hmm. where I have an amazing team of craftsmen. Some of them have been with me since the early days. The team that's sort of the most, have been with me the longest, are the ones who work on the first prototypes with me. My design studio, the building we're in almost looks like a school. We all work in the same building. We have our design studio on one floor. We have our most seasoned artisans who know me and have worked with me for, you know, 20, 30, 35 years. Work right next to us in the design studio. So we really speak this very cool language together where we design almost in tandem, you know, like we do drawings, we do sculpts, but quite often we just do it right on the floor with the craftsmen, where we'll be welding and joining and creating really just together. It's sort of a very different approach, but it's an approach that has always worked for me and my team. We have very talented designers who work alongside me, some of whom were students of mine who did their diploma projects in the design studio in New Delhi, and who upon graduation from the design academy there just joined as junior designers. I'm very proud to say that much of our organization is filled with really creative people who've been with me for years and years. And it's just a joy. You know, we all laugh. We all, you know, it's an amazing atmosphere, I would say.
That's incredible. Well, I want to ask you, because I've, you know, read in other interviews and articles you've done, you know, where you get your inspiration from. And I think this is translated so well into the product and into the craftsmanship that you have. But talk to me a little bit about what sparks your creativity when designing your home decor and your accessories.
You know, it can be so many different things. You know, we talked a little bit about craft. I'm so inspired by just the making process and seeing things made and understanding what can be made and exploring that, I would say, hopefully to its fullest potential. I've always been inspired by nature. You know, for me, the idea of, you know, understanding life, seeing things in all its forms, you know, is really fascinating. And I particularly love the randomness of nature paired with the unpredictability of the handmade process, you know? So there's like an organic process and an organic subject. And I think that there's things that happen when you take an organic subject, like an object from nature, and then make it in a handmade way where it almost gets amplified. I mean, this idea of I don't know. I mean, you know, we talk about, you know, the perfectly imperfect. We talk about, you know, the randomness of nature. But when you match that with the handmade process, it's unbelievable, you know.
And then you're creating pieces of art.
Truly. Yeah, well, you know, there's that moment. And also that pause, you know, I'll say, you know, that gives me a lot of joy when someone picks up a piece and, you know, maybe they know who I am. Maybe I'm with them. Maybe I see them in a store and they just look at it and they stop, you know. And there's that moment when they think, oh my gosh, you know, someone made this.
And the appreciation they have, because that, as you talk about India and seeing the craftsmanship and then coming back to your home and turning over the rugs or seeing, you know, all the detail and having that greater appreciation. Do you feel that your customers, you certainly have a cult following, I will say, and I want to talk about the cult following, because I think once you buy one of your pieces, there is that appreciation for the craftsmanship and what goes into that piece. How do you foster and sustain that loyal customer base and continue to communicate that this is all about the craftsmanship?
You know, thank you. Thank you.
Well, it's true.
She calls herself a collector, you know. You know, I meet people that I've been collecting your work for, you know, 25, since you started, and they'll come and I'll say, oh, thank you so much. But then they'll come and they'll show me a piece that they've owned for 35 years, you know? And, you know, I think for a long time, it was like, oh, they discovered something, you know, and they discovered something of mine and it meant something to them. And then they've sort of followed me through my career, you know, and stayed with me, which is, I think, so amazing for me, to witness. You know, it's just such an honor and a pleasure. And honestly, it's what fuels me and feeds me to continue. I just love that connection. And then to, you know, to hear her say, and I'll say her here, which is unfair, but largely her. And, you know, to hear her say, you know, things like, oh my gosh, you know, I was, you know, collecting that one, you know, collection of yours, and now you're doing all this other work. And, you know, darn it, I really, you know, now I have to buy that one too.
I have to buy more, right?
Yeah, I'm like, oh, sorry, you know.
But that's exactly
it. It's a dialogue, you know, it's a dialogue which continues. And I think as I grow and, you know, our team grows and we develop and we learn, and hopefully our language is getting a little bit more refined, or, you know, my sensibilities are changing, that, you know, hopefully my collectors are along for the ride, you know, and that we're able to also attract a newer, younger audience as well. You know, one of the things I don't like to say that I'm proud of, because, you know, I don't like that word, but one of the things I'm really pleased with is that, you know, we sell to grandma and granddaughter,
right?
You know, grandma loves us because she responds to something that's made by hand. Mm-hmm. You know, she looks at it and she thinks of it as having an heirloom quality to it. Mm. And her granddaughter loves it because it's so different and it's new and it doesn't feel stuffy. And, you know, she understands that, you know, I always say use things and abuse things, that our things are made for utility, that they're not meant for the china cabinet, that they only get better with age, and that you can use it every day and throw it in the dishwasher and really have fun with it, you know, and that it's not this precious object. You know, these are things to be enjoyed and used in your everyday. And that responds, you know, that's something that responds to her really well.
Yeah.
I think, you know. And that it doesn't really look like something that's antique. You know, it just has this, again, this I made this quality to it that, you know, I sometimes jokingly call it Williamsburg meets Williamsburg, if you know what I mean. You know, like, you know, we do this technique. I call it molten. We have these bowls with beaded edges, which are made by heating up rods of stainless steel to melting temperature, dropping that hot molten bead at the edge of the bowl, letting it cool, repeat, drop the bead on the edge of the bowl. If it's too hot, it'll just run down the side. If it's too cold, it doesn't stick to the steel. So it's really like, it's like jazz, you know, it's like heat, drop, repeat, repeat. Each bead is different, of course. And I always say they're like drops of rain, you know, each one is perfectly imperfect, dissimilar. When you look at the bowl, though, it looks like this classic English beaded, you know, beaded border. When you look closely, you'll realize that each single bead is put on individually, and that they're wonky, and some are chubbier, some are less thick, and that's that, you know, Williamsburg, Brooklyn meets Williamsburg, Virginia, and it's that grandma granddaughter thing, you know, that she can relate because it's handmade, and she can relate because it's something different, and that's my sweet spot, I think. You know, if we can do that, where we create pieces that are, I mean, you know, we don't look at trend. Trend is a bad word in my office, sorry to say. We don't look at trend, you know, either, you know, we just create objects that are original and not trendy. But I think that there's a lack of trend, which is really important to our work, and, you know, an authenticity and an originality. And I think when you have a sense of originality, and don't follow trend, there's a timelessness to the work that resonates with people.
Yeah. And that's where, you know, I first of all, I love that image, and I'm never going to look at one of your pieces the same again, to look at that originality and that beauty and the, you know, the perfection and the imperfection, right? And each one is different, is such a beautiful and unique thing. And I think you're right. These generations, you know, younger generation is looking for that. They want that, you know, something that's different and not like what everyone else has.
And we give her permission, you know, like we live in this world. I'm sorry to say, I love it all. Don't get me wrong, you know, but maybe we're not making, you know, formal sit-down dinners with five courses that took 10 hours to make. You know, we all live busy lives, urban lives. You know, Kate, you were saying, you know, how involved you were in the nonprofit world. And, you know, whether it's children, whether it's school, whether it's work, whether it's, you know, any number of things that pull us in 1,000 directions, we still want to have friends over. We still want to entertain. But we want to do it in a modern way, you know, a way that's going to work for us, you know. So I always say that with our work, we give permission to people, you know, tell your neighbors, hey, why don't you come over for a drink tonight, you know, and you lay it out with your beautiful, beautiful barware and your beautiful, beautiful cheese board. And you go to the market and you buy some beautiful things and you make a charcuterie board, or you put a cheese board together, or you serve a beautiful bottle of wine in a beautiful, you know, wine holder and with your napkin box, and really make it look special and beautiful, and that you considered your guests and that, you know, you took a moment. And I think when you entertain with beautiful things that allow you to entertain casually but elegantly, it goes a long way.
Absolutely.
You know? And it goes a long way.
Michael, did that change? So, you know, we went through COVID, right? No one was entertaining. What happened to the business during that time? And how have you evolved and grown coming out of COVID? How have things changed?
COVID actually was crazy for us. I mean, we were so busy during COVID, because I think it was almost the opposite. You know, I would get tagged on customers' posts where they were showing how they were cooking dinner for their family night after night after night, maybe dinners that they had not spent time making before, but now had the time and were doing it and really wanted to make it beautiful. So they would tag me and say, look how I'm serving dinner tonight. Or look at this table I've set, you know, and really wanted to make it special. So our business during COVID was really phenomenal. Also coupled by the fact that we had just moved our warehouse from just out of New York City and New Jersey to North Carolina. We expanded our space maybe five times for the warehouse. And so when we did that before COVID, we had just decided that we were going to fill it up and order, you know, really deep inventory. One of the things I always enjoy as the owner of the business is to be in a really positive inventory position, because so much of our work is gifted, whether it's through bridal registry or just, you know, in the stores where people find something, see it, love it, and want it, that we like to have a ready supply of product. So we had sort of intentionally really beefed up our inventory pre-COVID. And in a time when so many brands didn't have product to ship, we were really blessed that we had inventory.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And with your four stores that you have, because you have, remind me, you have New York, you have California, you have, where are your...
We have a boutique at the Shops at Bell Harbor in Miami. We have a beautiful flagship in West Hollywood on Beverly and Robertson. We have our first flagship in Chelsea in New York City, which had my design studio upstairs, which was always really special. And we've just opened a new store in the Topanga Mall in California as well.
Fantastic. And what is that experience? So in-store versus, you know, direct-to-consumer online, and obviously your wholesale as well. So where are you seeing the growth right now for the business?
Well, you know, we're seeing a lot of growth with our direct-to-consumer business. You know, we have just the four stores, which is not huge, but it's a nice incubator for us, I think. You know, I always talk about the New York store because my office was upstairs, and I could actually hear conversations from my office, you know, down to the cash register, and hear conversations about what people were buying, what they liked, what they responded to. I think it's really important. Again, it goes back to the ivory tower. You know, I've never wanted to design in an ivory tower or work. And I think that vertical integration and that connectedness to not only process, but end consumer is really important for me to understand, you know? And I think having the retail stores is really beneficial for that. Of course, you know, maybe as a result of COVID or as a byproduct of COVID, or just, you know, as a result of the way the world is changing, we do see greater online sales, not only with our own website, but of course also with the websites of many of our national partners as well, which has been phenomenal.
Yeah, fantastic. And in terms of the continuous evolution of the brand and you know what you've been working on, you and I, before we jumped on and started taping here, we were talking about the evolution into jewelry. And I loved your story about the butterfly, and I know that was the start of your jewelry with your daughter. Tell us a little bit about the direction you're going in and these different line extensions that you've gotten into. And certainly that butterfly story was beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, for me, jewelry's always been sort of the holy grail, you know, as someone who's dedicated his career to work in metal. I've never been a snob when I look at material, because for me, it's always about, you know, the intent really more than the monetary value of a piece. You know, we put as much love into a, you know, $90,000 necklace, a $40,000 sculpture, or a, you know, $50 beautiful, you know, object for the table. You know, everything has as much design intent behind it. Mm-hmm. But I do think that when something's worn on the body, that it's, I don't know, it's just, there's, for me as the creator, to have it become part of that person, identified with their personality, worn so intimately and cherished so much, really is an unbelievable experience for me as a creative person, you know, to know that when people buy jewelry, they're thinking about, you know, why they're buying it, who they're giving it to, you know, is it an occasion piece? You know, is it a celebration piece? Maybe who one day they'll give it to again, you know? I mean, there's such an intensity. It's not a casual purchase.
Yeah.
And I think that's true, whether it's a piece of fine jewelry or a piece of, you know, a fashion jewelry as well. It's a piece that you really consider. You try it on, you look at it. Is it me? You know, how is it going to feel? How does it wear? How does it move? You know, there's so many components to it that it's a really exciting experience for me to design into that category. So that for me is the ultimate. I will say jewelry is the ultimate for me.
That's really what you're most excited about at this time as you grow.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because we have a Michael Arum fine jewelry collection, and I have a daughter, Annabelle, who is such a girly girl and always loves jewelry. And I had this butterfly necklace that I made, and you and I were joking how our butterflies are not butterflies. And I always make a point to say it's not a butterfly. I love designing objects of nature, of flora, and I'm not someone who does a lot of fauna. And mm-hmm. I love that our butterflies are actually leaves and twigs, and nobody sees it until you say it. But it was inspired by a tree outside my bedroom window in New York City, which is a butterfly ginkgo tree, Ginkgo biloba. And when you look at the tree, it looks like the tree is full of butterflies. And I love that, you know, you can perceive that tree, which is a plant, you know, it's not an animal, but you look at it and you see the butterflies in the tree. And there was one day when I had my bedroom window open on the second floor, and in flew the leaves fluttering onto my bed. And I just had that moment where I just thought, how poetic to imagine those leaves as butterflies born from the cocoon, flying off the branch. And when they land on the branch, metamorphosing into leaves and twigs. I love that story of metamorphosis. I love the symbolism of the ginkgo tree as you know, the most ancient tree in civilization. It's a prehistoric tree. It survives everything. It's a symbol of health, well-being, resilience. There's a reason it's the New York City street tree, because it will survive absolutely anything.
Tough New Yorker.
So I really love that symbolism of the butterfly ginkgo as something that metamorphoses from tree to butterfly, or from leaf to butterfly, and is symbolic of so much strength and resilience and well-being.
Which goes to, again, the strength and resilience of the product that you're creating, but the beauty of what you have created. It sort of brings it all full circle.
Well, and there's something nice about metal. You know, I will say, you know, there's a little ego there, because, you know, when you look at history and look at artifacts and look at what survives, you know, quite often it's objects in metal. So, you know, as much as you capture a spontaneous moment, you know, I always talk about like our process, and we go from liquid to solid in a flash. You know, when you cast something and you pour that hot molten metal into the sand mold, it takes probably seconds to harden. And then it's there for all eternity, which is really exciting.
That's incredible. Well, Michael, we could talk for hours and hours, because I love hearing your stories and truly what you have created here. And as you continue to create, I want to ask one last question for our listeners, because they're going to go to your website and they're going to go to your social media and see the beauty. But what does the future hold for Michael Arum? You talked about the excitement of jewelry and fine jewelry and continuing to evolve, but is there anything in particular that you've got your eye set on as you continue to grow the business?
Well, thank you. There are several things we're looking at. There's new categories that we're excited by. We're in the moment very excited about home textiles and designing more into that category, which is very thrilling. But truly the thing that I'm most excited about is more of a global expansion. We're talking to, of course, we've always shown in Paris at the Maison Show. We sell to over 60 countries around the world, but really deepening our footprint in the rest of the world markets is something that I'm very excited by. This past year, we set up an office in Valencia, Spain, and have distribution now set up there, which will certainly help us with our European market. And we're looking beyond that to Asia and the Middle East as well, which is completely thrilling for me.
Yeah, very exciting. And again, your website sales and retail sales and continued success. So I'm thank you for taking the time and talking to us. As I said, I've been a huge fan for many years, and I have a very deep appreciation and a greater respect for what you do. And I'm never, as I said, going to look at one of your bowls again the same way with those drops. Now I think of them as raindrops. So it's really beautiful and so grateful for having you on the safari. So thank you, Michael.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Kate. It's been a pleasure. And thank you so much for your interview.
Well, thank you.
If you want to learn a little bit more about Traub, you can go to traub.io, where you'll learn a lot about everything that we do. If you're enjoying the safari, please do share it with your friends and colleagues within the industry. And please also don't forget to subscribe and like it. Until next time.